right, we've made it through one unit out of five, but we're actually a quarter of the way through the term. It's because unit one has actually one more chapter than the others. So starting today, starting with unit two, the rest of the units will be three chapters each. The first of the chapters in unit two that we're looking at right now is all about organic macromolecules. And I think that we've gone through this list before, but it's important to start with the list of biological macromolecules. There's four categories of biological macromolecules that all organisms are made out of, for the most part. Now, macromolecules are big molecules. That's what macro means, big. It's not the only molecules that organisms are made out of. There's water in there. There's other things that are small molecules by comparison. But all organisms contain all four categories of biological macromolecules that are a lot bigger than most molecules. And does anyone remember or know what these four categories are?
Lipids
is one of them, yes?
Starch
is an example of one of the categories. So what category does starch belong to? No, starch is bigger than a disaccharide. Di means two. So sucrose, for instance, table sugar, is a disaccharide. That's not a macromolecule because it's not big enough. But when you hook together a bunch of monosaccharides to make a big molecule, it's polysaccharides. And that's one of the categories. Now, some people will teach you incorrectly that one of the categories is carbohydrates. Polysaccharides are carbohydrates, but so are monosaccharides and disaccharides. So carbohydrates is a huge category that includes not only macromolecules, but also small molecules. So when we're talking about the four categories of biological macromolecules, it's specifically the big carbohydrates, which is polysaccharides. That's the second category, or there's no order to them, but what are the other two that we haven't mentioned? Yeah.
Proteins
is kind of a tricky word. I'll explain more later. It's not technically wrong to say that one of the categories is proteins, but a better word for the third category is polypeptides. And later on, I'll tell you why. Sometimes the word polypeptide and protein and the word protein are interchangeable. Sometimes they mean the same thing. Sometimes they don't. What's the one that we haven't mentioned? Nucleic acids, correct. Which, it's correct to call them that, but they can go by a different name as well, which is polynucleotide. So those are really, the four best words for the categories are polynucleotide, polysaccharide, polypeptide, and lipid. Now, which one of those four seems to stand out from the rest?
Lipid.
Because linguistically it stands out, right? Because it doesn't have poly in it. When you use these words for the other three, not only is it entirely correct to describe the macromolecules, but it also linguistically reminds you of something that's important about those three, or that's true of those three that isn't true of lipids. All four of these are macromolecule categories, but only three of them, the ones with poly in the name, are more specifically polymers. A polymer, or the word polymer literally means many part. Mer means part, poly means many. Polymers are not only macromolecules, but they're macromolecules that are formed by hooking together a bunch of subunits, one-parters, that are called monomers. Lipids aren't built that way. So they are macromolecules, but they're not polymers. I wanted to point that out because it's important as it is, but also because this opening slide, notice, uses the words polymer and monomer. it's true. What is pointed out in this slide that I'm about to tell you is true of all the polymers, but it's also true of the way lipids are built. So don't be confused by that. What's important about this slide is true of all four categories. And what we see here is that a larger molecule can be built by hooking smaller pieces together. Smaller molecules can be hooked together to form bigger molecules. And that's what's happening in these first two lines of the slide. And regardless of which type of macromolecule is being discussed here, and so this is just a generic example, so it's true of all four categories, if you're hooking two things together to build a bigger thing in biology, each of those two smaller chunks is going to feature something hanging off of it. One piece is going to have a hydrogen somewhere. One piece is going to have an OH somewhere. That's the scheme here. All right? And that's important because those two pieces of the smaller chunks are what allow the two chunks to be covalently bonded together to build a bigger chunk. And it happens because one of the smaller chunks is going to lose the H. The other chunk is going to lose the OH. And just think about this in ball and stick modeling. To do that, you would be emptying some holes, right? Which allows for those holes then to be hooked together using a new stick. You remove the H from one, the OH from the other, and that allows, in this case, 3 and 4 to be hooked together. And now you have a bigger piece. But what happens to the H and the OH? Well, they get together, the two H's and the O, to form water. All right? And so that's why this general reaction that is used in biology to hook two pieces, smaller pieces, together to form a bigger piece is called a dehydration reaction. Dehydration linguistically means removal of water. Well, the water comes from removing an H from one chunk and an OH from the other chunk. It becomes water, but that allows the two pieces then to be hooked together covalently. All right? That's dehydration. That's a reversible reaction. Dehydration always builds a bigger piece out of two smaller pieces, but you can do exactly the opposite, which is shown on the bottom part of the slide. This piece that's larger, was previously built, can be dismantled, in other words, by doing exactly the reverse. And so by breaking the bond between 3 and 4 here, you're going to have empty holes, right, that need to be filled in each chunk. One of them gets filled from an H that comes from water, and one of them gets filled with an OH that comes from the same water. It's exactly the reverse process. So water is required to do this, and it results in a splitting of the bigger chunk. Well, a word that means splitting is lysis, L-Y-S-I-S. To lyse, L-Y-S-E, the verb, means to split. And since it involves water, this particular splitting is called hydrolysis. All right? It's not that the water is split, it's water is used to, well, water is split, but it's used to split the big chunk into two. Okay? That's some general background information that's true for all four of them. For the rest of this slideshow, we'll one by one go through the four categories of macromolecules. And we'll start with polysaccharides as a category, even though what you see here on slide 2 are not polysaccharides. All of these molecules that you see each individually as a structural formula is all of these are monosaccharides, which are carbohydrates, but they are not big carbohydrates. So these aren't macromolecules. They're shown here, though, because they're the building blocks or the monomers that can be used as subunits to be put together to build a polysaccharide. Monosaccharides are important in their own right. They are the major fuels in all organisms. Cells primarily use monosaccharides as fuel sources. They extract energy from the chemical bond in those monosaccharides to do the energy-requiring activities that cells need to perform in order to stay alive. But these are not polysaccharides. They are monosaccharides. And another word, another phrase for monosaccharides is simple sugar. When you see that phrase, that means a monosaccharide specifically. There are disaccharides that are made of two monosaccharides hooked together. There are oligosaccharides. The prefix oligo means several but not many. And then when you have enough, it's officially a polysaccharide. Okay. This is just a tiny sampling of the total number of possible monosaccharides. There's really no limit to the number. You don't see all that many in foods because organisms really keep using the same set of monosaccharides pretty much. But in a chemical lab, you could produce as many as different kinds of monosaccharides as you wanted. This arrangement that you see in this table illustrates two completely different ways of categorizing or classifying monosaccharides. One way is shown in the columns, another way is shown in the rows. And the two ways don't have anything to do with each other. It's just two different ways of classifying them. But before we compare those two ways, just notice that all of these monosaccharides share something, right? Which is illustrated by the orange highlighting. What is highlighted in orange? It's not a carboxyl. There is a double bond. It's a carbonyl group. Yes. Monosaccharides, when they are in the linear form, which all of these are in, feature a carbonyl somewhere. All right? And that's why, by the way, going back to this week's lab, monosaccharides are called reducing sugars because that carbonyl is a source of an electron that can reduce something else by being oxidized, by the sugar being oxidized. Okay, now remember when we talked about the carbonyl group in the functional groups discussion that there are two possible placements for it and therefore two categories of substances that contain carbonyl. If the carbonyl is at a tip, what is that substance classified as? What's the category that has carbonyls at the tip? Not necessarily. I'm talking about in general, anything that has a carbonyl at a tip of the skeleton. What are they called? Aldehydes. Correct. And if it's not at a tip, they are categorized as what? Ketones. Well, sugars all have, all monosaccharides have carbonyls. So any given individual monosaccharide is either an aldehyde or a ketone, depending on where its carbonyl is, right? The suffix that means sugar is OSE. And that's why we can lump together all the monosaccharides that have their carbonyls at a tip somewhere as aldehyde sugars, but one word that means that is aldoses. All right. Aldose is not a substance. It's a category of monosaccharides. Each of these, glyceraldehyde, ribose, glucose, galactose, are aldehyde sugars or aldoses. If a monosaccharide has its carbonyl anywhere other than the tip, then it's a ketone instead. A ketone sugar is called a ketose. So OSE as an ending tells you you're talking about a carbohydrate, whether it's a monosaccharide, a polysaccharide, whatever. All right, that way of classifying the monosaccharides has nothing to do with what the columns are indicating. You can also categorize monosaccharides based on the size of the carbon skeleton. In other words, how many carbons are in that monosaccharide. And glyceraldehyde and dihydroxyacetone share the fact that they each have three carbons. They're separate substances. They're different sugars, but they each have the same chemical formula. They each have three carbons, and therefore they are called trioses, a three-carbon sugar. And notice that pentoses have five sugars, because pent means five. Hexoses have six, and so on. That's a different way of categorizing them. And what you should have noticed by building glucose, which is an example of a hexose, you built this one, but you can see here that it's true of all these monosaccharides, is that there's also plenty of OHs, right? Which makes any monosaccharide what kind of substance?
Alcohols.
They're alcohols as well, because all it requires is one or more OH to be an alcohol. All right. Now to two. What we looked at in that previous slide were structural formulae for monosaccharides in the linear form. But I mentioned in lab, to make sense of the Benedict's test, that any given monosaccharide can exist in either linear or ringed form. And it's the same stuff, just two versions of it. We see that happening here with a hexose that's in linear form as you build it on the left. But if you bring the carbon skeleton back around and hook it to itself, you form a ring. And this is the same substance, just in ringed form. But notice that to do that, you have to break bonds in the model to sew it together. And therefore, you lose the double bond of the carbonyl. There's a carbonyl group only in the linear form of the sugar. In the ring form, there isn't. And this is why Benedict's test works for monosaccharides, but not for disaccharides or above. Because when you get to hooking monosaccharides together to make bigger carbohydrates, like a disaccharide or a polysaccharide, the individual monosaccharides have to be in the ringed form in order to hook them together. And when you do that, it locks them in the ring form permanently, as long as they're members of that bigger molecule. Therefore, no carbonyl groups. Therefore, no ability to reduce the copper ions. Does that make more sense now? All right. This is reversible, though. As long as this is just a single monosaccharide in ring form, it can immediately go back to the linear form. So it flips back and forth many times a second until or unless it's hooked to another monosaccharide. Then it stays in the ring form.
Well, you've got to break it up and then...
That's right. In your hydrolysis part, you started with sucrose, which is a disaccharide, locked into the ring form, but when you subjected it to acid and heat, it broke that bond, and now you have two ring forms of the monosaccharide that can each go back to linear form, and that is what allows it to turn the copper ions to copper one. Slide four shows you how ringed forms of monosaccharides can be hooked together. This follows the scheme that we saw in slide one. You're making a bigger thing, right? And so each of your two smaller chunks are going to have some requirements that need to be met. One of them has to have an OH somewhere, which sugars do. One of them has to have an H somewhere. So you can see the H and the OH coming out as water to allow these two monosaccharides, which just happen to both be glucose, to be hooked together to form what's called maltose, an example of a disaccharide, because it's two monosaccharides big. It's a bigger sugar. All right, so this is a more complex carbohydrate than glucose is. And when that happens, what kind of reaction is that? It's a dehydration reaction. That's why water is removed from the situation. But that's the general name, no matter what kind of bigger chunk you're making, it's dehydration that's going to do that. But in the specific case of building a bigger carbohydrate, a bigger sugar, out of monosaccharides hooked together, then not only is it a dehydration reaction, but that specific bond that's produced is called a glycosidic linkage. It's a covalent bond, but it gets that specific name, glycosidic linkage. And glyco means sugar. Okay, well, maltose is just one of many possible disaccharides. There are multiple different disaccharides because there are multiple different monosaccharides, and you can hook any two of them together. For instance, on the bottom, we have a dehydration reaction occurring between glucose and fructose instead. So they don't have to be the same monosaccharide you're hooking together. It can be two different ones. That forms what we call table sugar. Sucrose is a disaccharide. Now, before I leave this, notice that the reaction is occurring involving specific OHs that are highlighted. But because monosaccharides have so many OHs in them, that means there's the possibility of multiple ways you can hook, multiple places at which you can hook different monosaccharides together. And that means you could actually hook two to the same one, forming a branch. When you form large polysaccharides by hooking together a bunch of monosaccharides, you could hook them all end to end, which would be a linear one, or you could actually branch it because there are multiple choices of OH as connection points. I think there's a picture of that. A little bit, so in slide five. Slide five shows you two examples of important polysaccharides, but these are both, even though one is from plant and one is from animal, so they are different substances slightly, they are both examples of a category, an important category of polysaccharide called a storage polysaccharide. The two major categories that I'll talk about are storage polysaccharides and structural polysaccharides. This slide shows you only storage polysaccharides. And the reason these are called storage polysaccharides, or any storage polysaccharide is called that, is that it is built to begin with by hooking together a bunch of monosaccharides for the purpose of storing energy for later. Well, a little bit ago I said that monosaccharides are the main fuel in all cells of all organisms. To be used as fuel, you have to have it in monosaccharide form. And we'll get into how that happens in Unit 3, how the fuel actually gets used. It has to start as a monosaccharide, though, to be used as fuel. In other words, when you have a bunch of monosaccharides hooked together, that's not really a fuel. But as long as you just dismantle that polysaccharide into monosaccharides, the monosaccharides can be used as fuel. So it's a very efficient way when you have more monosaccharides than you need for immediate use of fuel. It's a more efficient way to store them for later use by hooking them all together and taking up slightly less space. That's what a storage polysaccharide is. And we're just using plants and animals as two major groups of organisms to show you how they do this. They really do it the same way. They hook together not only monosaccharides, but the most important monosaccharide in biology as far as fuel is concerned, which is glucose specifically. Glucose is the main fuel. And in your body, your brain uses almost nothing but glucose as fuel. So if you don't have glucose on hand, your body changes other things into glucose or you die. But anyway, these are not only polysaccharides, which by definition are big molecules made with a bunch of monosaccharides, but specifically in this these cases, every one of these individual monosaccharides that you see as a little hexagon is specifically glucose. And therefore, every one of them is a fuel if it were by itself. This is just a way of hooking a bunch of fuel molecules together for the purpose of later dismantling it. In your daily life, you know, if you eat a meal, that's once that meal is digested and then absorbed into your cells, there's going to be a lot of glucose coming in from the food you ate. Okay, because you digest it in individual glucose molecules before you absorb it into your body, at the digestive tract. There's going to be way more coming in than you need to spend as fuel at the moment. So a major job of your liver and your skeletal muscles is to take that extra glucose that's coming in, hook them together and make what is called glycogen, the animal version of storage polysaccharide. Glycogen isn't built in order to form some sort of strong structure. It's built for the purpose of storing energy for later. After it's been many hours since you've eaten and your glucose that was available in your bloodstream has been consumed for fuel by your brain and other parts of your body, the glucose level drops, in other words, then your liver, which has previously, right after the meal, formed a bunch of glycogen out of all that incoming glucose, will reverse the process and break the glycogen back down into individual glucose molecules, put them into the bloodstream so that your brain and therefore you can stay alive. So that's what storage polysaccharides are. Plants also form storage polysaccharides out of pure glucose monomers, but notice that they have much less branching. Their version is called starch. There can be some branching, but not as much as there is in glycogen. And animals have evolved to make their storage polysaccharide glycogen with a lot more branching, because the more branching you have, the more tips there are overall. And it's the tips at which you can one by one pick off individual glucoses. So you can do it a lot quicker in an animal, which is important for us because we're so active moment to moment. We require energy more quickly than plants do. Those are storage polysaccharides. Slide 6. Well, not only is there a linear and a ringed version for any given monosaccharide, but there can actually be multiple different versions of the same ringed form. As you see here, these are both glucose, the ringed forms. But one of them is alpha glucose and one of them is beta glucose. They're actually separate versions of glucose. And the only difference, which you can see highlighted in the ringed forms, is that this blue hydroxyl on alpha glucose is below this plane, and the other one, it's flipped, so it's above the plane. It's just in a different position. And that doesn't seem like it's much of a difference, but it makes a difference when you go to the business of hooking them together. So if you hook together a bunch of alpha glucose monomers like you do down here, you make starch, which is a storage polysaccharide made by plants. If you hook them together using beta glucose, it looks like the same thing, but notice it's not. There's a staggering of these yellow highlighted OHs, and that makes a different molecule called cellulose. Cellulose is an example of a structural polysaccharide, because it's not built for the purpose of using the monomers it's made out of later for fuel, even though they could be, because they're glucose. The intention in building this from the beginning is to keep it together as a strong molecule, like a strand of a rope. It has high tensile strength because of these glycosidic linkages holding them together. And if you build a bunch of these, each like a fiber of a rope, and get them side by side, in parallel, in other words, you can build what is more or less a rope. You can see that in slide 7. So structural polysaccharides are all about building structures. They're more or less permanent, even though they can be dismantled. They're not there just to temporarily store energy. Now, the glucose that is each of these monomers, this is nothing but glucoses, but many, many of them. Each individual glucose, if it were on its own, could certainly be used as a fuel. And that means that the cellulose, which we take a lot of in whenever you eat a plant, a lot of the carbohydrate that's coming in is in the form of cellulose. Some of it's in the form of starch. Starch we can easily break down and use as fuel. Cellulose we can't, even though it's chock full of energy because it's nothing but glucose. We can't use it unless it's in monosaccharide form. And we don't have the ability to break the glycosidic linkages between those beta glucoses to digest cellulose, which is why it just passes through us as roughage. In slide 8, we see a cow, which is a fellow mammal related to us, right? Eating grass, which is rich in cellulose. And the reason that it gets nutrients from this, or from paper, which is mostly cellulose, if it ate paper, is not because it's able to break those glycosidic linkages in the cellulose. Just like we can't, this fellow mammal can't either. So you eat cellulose, you don't get any nutritive value. But the cow does. Not because the cow can digest it, though. Instead, it's because in one of the cow's stomachs, it has bacteria living in it. This is an example of a symbiosis, which is more of a Bio 182 topic. Osis means condition, bio means life, and sim means together. So a symbiosis is a close living arrangement between two species. This is even more specifically an example of endosymbiosis, endo meaning within, because one of the two species is living inside the other. Bacteria do have the enzymes, the proteins required to break the bonds between those glucose monomers in cellulose. And why do they have that enzyme? What gives them the ability to make that particular protein? All enzymes are proteins. What is it that gives any organism the ability to produce a certain kind of protein? I talked about this on day one, I think, just briefly. No, amino acids are the building blocks required for it. But what gives the cell the ability to assemble a particular kind of protein? How does it know how to do that? DNA. That's exactly what a gene is. A gene is a set of instructions in DNA form that tells the cell how to build a particular kind of protein. And if you don't have the instructions, the cell's never going to be able to do it. Well, the bacterium has the gene to build the perfectly shaped protein, the enzyme, that's able to break the bonds between the adjacent glucoses that make up the cellulose. So they can digest cellulose and then use the monosaccharide glucoses as fuel. The cow can't, just like we can't. If we had the right gene, we could. But the cow gets the benefit from the symbiosis, this living arrangement, because and it's symbiosis because both of them benefit. The cow benefits because it gets energy, it gets nutrients from cellulose that it wouldn't if it otherwise passed through it, through them just like it does us. The bacteria benefit because they have a nice, safe, moist, warm place to live their whole life. And they're getting a continuous, free source of food as the cow eats. So they both benefit. Slide 9 is here to show you that it's not just plants that make structural polysaccharides. There are animal versions as well, including what's shown here, which is called chitin. Chitin is very strong, like structural polysaccharides should be, and it's the chief component of exoskeletons of insects. We mammals have endoskeletons, right? The hard part of us is deep inside us, and then soft stuff around it. Insects are soft in the middle, and then they have a plate armor, more or less, holding it together or protecting it outside. And that plate armor or exoskeleton is made of animal version of structural polysaccharide. And we take advantage of its strength by making it into surgical thread. All right, 10. In 10... we're switching gears because I've just gotten through one of the four categories, which is polysaccharides. Now we're entering into lipids. And remember that among the four categories, lipids is the only one of the four that is not a polymer officially. The other three are. So they are built a little bit differently, that it's not just an arbitrarily big end-to-end arrangement of monosaccharides, like polymers, I mean of... monomers like polymers are. But despite not being as huge, they still are built using dehydration reactions, which means the parts that are put together still have an OH for one part and an H for another part. You can see that right here at the top, where one fatty acid, that's just the orange part, is being hooked to one glycerol molecule, which is just the gray part. The complete product, if this happens three times, is shown below. And this is a fat, which is an example of a lipid. Which reminds me, by the way, to say that sometimes people use the word fat and lipid interchangeably. That's wrong. If you think about it in terms of sets, lipid is the bigger set. And fats is just one subset within that bigger set. In other words, all fats are lipids, but not all lipids are fats. So don't use them interchangeably. A fat goes by any of three names. Fat is the easiest to say and spell. But a fat can also be called a triglyceride or a triacyl glycerol. Now, a chef is likely to call it a fat. A biologist is likely to call it a triglyceride. A biochemist is likely to call it a triacyl glycerol. But they're all interchangeable words. They all refer to exactly the same thing. And it's also important that I say a fat, because there are many different kinds of fat molecules. But these two words that have the tri in them and the glis are more descriptive, because they show you what the picture indicates, which is how these things are built. You start with a glycerol molecule. Now, just looking at glycerol, just the word itself tells you that it is what?
Sugar. Or a polymer?
What does the just looking at the word itself, what is it's an alcohol. That's why it ends in OL, right? It's not only an alcohol, it's a triple alcohol because it has three hydroxyls, right? So that a glycerol is a molecule in its own right if it exists by itself. That's a starting point. That's one chunk. A fatty acid is also by itself a complete molecule. And a fatty acid has this at the end. What am I circling here? That's a carboxyl group. But that's just one end of a fatty acid. What is the entire rest of the molecule? How would you describe that in chemical terms? It is a carbon skeleton, but more specifically. Did you say carbonyl? Carbonyl? There's a methyl at the very end. But how would you describe all of this? What's it made out of?
Carbons and
hydrocarbon. Hydrocarbon, right. Now, the overall fatty acid is not technically a hydrocarbon, right? Because it has this oxygen that's part of the carboxyl. But the whole rest of it, besides that carboxyl, is really a hydrocarbon chain. And what did I say about hydrocarbons in general? Other than they are formed of only hydrogen and carbon? I said that they make excellent fuels, which is what gasoline is. It's a mixture of a bunch of hydrocarbons because there's a bunch of CH bonds. There's a lot of energy in there that can be tapped. This is why fats are so important as sources of fuel. But fatty acids and fats are not the same things. A fatty acid is just one part of a bigger molecule called a fat. The carboxyl end of the fatty acid, though, is what allows it to be hooked via a dehydration reaction to a glycerol. The H from the glycerol comes off. The OH from the fatty acid comes off. That's what makes it a dehydration reaction. Out comes water. And that sews together covalently the fatty acid and the glycerol. All right? This would be, if that's where you stop, that would be a monoglyceride, because it's glycerol with just one fatty acid. But there's two more OHs available, two more spots on that same glycerol where you can do the same thing. In other words, hook two more fatty acids to it. In this case, they all happen to be the same fatty acid that's in all three cases. It doesn't have to be the case because there are different kinds of fatty acids even. These all happen to be the same kind of fatty acid. But when you do that all three times and you use all the connection points on the glycerol, then you have an overall fat or triglyceride or triacyl glycerol. Triacyl glycerol refers to the fact that these fatty acids are acyl groups and there's three of them connected to a glycerol. Okay, so that is one fat molecule. And just like we gave a specific name to the covalent bond that's formed between adjacent monosaccharides in a di or bigger sugar. What was that called, by the way? Glycosidic linkage, when you're hooking together monosaccharides. Well, when you're hooking together a fatty acid and a glycerol, that is called an ester linkage. So there are three ester linkages in a fat, one for each of the three constituent fatty acids involved. Okay, now before we leave this, let me just ask you, well, based on what I just told you, which is that there are multiple different kinds of fatty acids, these all happen to be the same, what is it that could be different? Why are these all the same? What's the same about them? Yeah, but so does methane, which is different from these, right? How is it that you could have this overall fact that you have a carboxyl and then a hydrocarbon chain, but do it differently? What could be different about another fatty acid?
It could be like a little change where it changes
the
direction.
Yeah, for a different reason that's important that I'll talk about in a minute. But the simpler thing that I was hoping you would come up with is that there's nothing saying you have to end here.
Oh.
Right?
Fair enough.
This there can be as many carbons as you want in it, right?
Yeah.
And there could be fewer than this. This could be where your methyl is, and that's the end. So one reason why there are multiple different kinds of fatty acids is simply they differ in their chain length, the number of carbons. All right? There's another important way, though, which is what you were getting at, in which fatty acids can differ, and that's what's illustrated in slide 11. Fatty acids are classified, based on this difference that I'm about to talk about, as either saturated or unsaturated. Now, these words are used to describe fat here, but first, they're used to describe fatty acids, not an entire fat. An individual fatty acid, which is a carboxyl with a hydrocarbon tail, is either saturated or unsaturated. So what makes the difference? Well, the ones we looked at in the previous slide were all unsaturated, just like the one... they were all saturated, sorry, just like the one shown here at the top in A. What does the word saturated mean in everyday language? Well, not necessarily too many, but full, right? Means it's holding as much as it possibly can, like a saturated rag. You can get it, can't get it any wetter. No more water is going to go into a saturated rag. In this case, what saturation refers to is being full of hydrogen atoms, holding as many as possible. Now, let me temporarily go back, because it's easier to look at this picture, to slide 10. Notice that every one of these fatty acids has, except for the carboxyl end, which has, of course, a double bond, for all the hydrocarbon part of the fatty acid, there are only single bonds between the carbons. And every given individual carbon has a valence of 4, so it's making 4 bonds, right? It has to fill 4 holes. But 2 of them are with carbons around them. That leaves 2 empty holes. So you can fit 2 hydrogens in there. And at the very end, you can fit 3, right? Well, If you make a double bond between two adjacent carbons, in order to do that, you're going to have to get rid of some hydrogens to make the holes open, right? These have the maximum number of hydrogens, though, for the number of carbons they have. So they are saturated with hydrogen. That's why they're called saturated fatty acids. As soon as you get one or more double bonds in the hydrocarbon chain of a fatty acid, though, like right here, that's a double bond, then you no longer can hold as many hydrogens because you had to give up those hydrogens to make the double bond. So one double bond between carbons or more qualifies the fatty acid as unsaturated. And not only does it lose some hydrogen because of that, but notice that it forms a little kink or a bend in the otherwise linear arrangement of the hydrocarbon tail. So this has important biological implications. Animals, including us, tend to make more of their fatty acids as saturated fatty acids. Plants more so make unsaturated fatty acids that are bent. Now, up to now, I've been using the words saturated or unsaturated to refer to individual fatty acids. We can also apply these terms to overall fats, though. Remember, a fat, to be a fat, is just a glycerol with three fatty acids of some type connected to it. Well, if every one of the three fatty acids in a fat is a saturated fatty acid, then the overall fat is a saturated fat. That's what we see at the top. Each of these has only single bonds. If the overall fat includes at least one fatty acid that is unsaturated, then the entire fat is unsaturated. They don't have to all be unsaturated. Just like here, these two are saturated, but this one's not. Therefore, the overall fat is unsaturated. Now, if you think about this bending by analogy with wires, imagine having a bunch of stiff wires like coat hanger. Do they still make wire coat hangers? I haven't seen one in a while. But anyway, stiff wires, and they can be even different lengths, just like fatty acids can be different lengths, right? The wires are the fatty acids. If you only have saturated fatty acids, you only have unbent wires, straight wires, then you don't have to be all that careful if you put them into a box, because they will pack together nicely, side by side, right? Since there's no bends anywhere. But if you have a bunch of them that are bent, and they're bent at different places especially, and you try to just haphazardly throw them into the same box, they're not going to pack together nearly as well. There's going to be a bunch of space between them because of those bends. Similarly, a saturated fat is more compact. And more compact means more like a solid, because solids have the spacing, very tight spacing between particles. That's why animal fats tend to be more solid at room temperature, like butter or lard. But plant fats are mostly unsaturated. They don't pack together as much, so they are more like liquids, oils. And the same will be true later when we talk about membrane fluidity, but that's a different chapter. Okay. That's fats, which is just one category, important category of lipids. By the way, before we transition to this next type of lipid, let me say that fats are important because of their nutritional density. They have a much higher energy density than other nutrients do. Proteins, for instance, and carbohydrates, which are nutrient classes, have much lower energy density. The energy density is how much energy is stored in 1 gram of that stuff. 1 gram of fat contains more than twice as much energy as 1 gram of carbohydrate or 1 gram of protein. And this is why when we take in more energy as food originally than we need based on our metabolism and activity level, We store it for later, but we don't store it as what it comes in as. Instead, whatever it comes in as, like candy is pure carbohydrate. Candy manufacturers love to say no fat on the label. It's true, there's no fat in that form. But if we're taking it in and storing it for later, we transform it into fat so that we can store it much more efficiently. If we had to store that same amount of energy as protein or as carbohydrate in our body, we would have to weigh a lot more to hold that same amount of energy, and that would make it more difficult for us to move around. Yeah.
Fats are high energy. Then why, when we eat like a lot of fat stuff, we feel like we have less energy?
Because of the same thing I was talking about for polysaccharides not being fuels yet, but they can be processed into fuels by dismantling them. Same is true for fats. The fats aren't the fuels, the fatty acids are, but you have to digest them first. And your body has a certain amount of glycogen that it can store, and that glycogen can be used very quickly because all we have to do is pick off those glucoses. And that's what we're doing. You know, that's why marathon runners load up on pasta or some other very starchy meal right before, because they want to maximize the amount of glycogen that's in their body so they can run longer before they collapse. When you run out of that glycogen, though, which you do eventually, depending on your activity level, then your body starts dismantling the fat that you have stored on your body. But that takes metabolic time to do, and that's why you feel that way until it gets mobilized. Oh, I haven't talked about 12 yet. Slide 12 is not only another important category of lipids, but this one is, I've talked about this a little bit already, indispensable to life. It's you can't overestimate how important this category of molecule is. What we're looking at here is a phospholipid. No cells, no life would exist without this. If you look at the picture and compare it to your mental picture of what you've already seen as a fat, you can see that it's very similar. A fat or a triglyceride is a glycerol with three fatty acids hooked to it, right? Well, here we have a glycerol as well, but there's only two fatty acids connected to it. The glycerol still has a third place that you can hook something, right? But instead of that third position on glycerol being used for another fatty acid, which would make it a fat if that happened, instead, here, we're hooking it to a phosphate group, which is itself then hooked to something else. That's why this is called a phospholipid, because a phosphate is hooked to the glycerol. Now, think back to the functional groups. The phosphate, which you can see here, is the phosphorus atom with four oxygen atoms, right? But a couple of those oxygen atoms are ionized, right? Which means the phosphate group is not polar, it's beyond polar. It's fully charged, right? But the fatty acid tails are mostly hydrocarbons, or mostly carbons and hydrogens. And hydrocarbons in general, not just fats, hydrocarbons as fuel, whatever, are nonpolar molecules. What makes them nonpolar? No. Oxygen, pure oxygen gas is nonpolar, and it's nothing but oxygen.
No electronegativity.
There is electronegativity.
But it's all stable.
Stable is not quite the right descriptor there. What makes any given nonpolar substance nonpolar? Or molecule, I should say. What? No, that's not true, because hydrocarbons are carbon and hydrogen, two elements. Right. For a bond to be nonpolar, that means equal sharing, and that's only going to be equal sharing if the two electronegativity values, one for each of the two atoms, is the same. In other words, if their greediness for the electrons is equal, and therefore no one wins out. Well, carbon and hydrogen are different elements, and they do have different values of electronegativity, but it's damn close. So even though it's not perfect, it's equal sharing. A CH bond is nonpolar, and therefore hydrocarbons overall are nonpolar, because a carbon is either involved in a CC bond, which is perfectly nonpolar, right? It's equal sharing, or a CH bond, which is very close to perfectly sharing. That's why hydrocarbons do not mix with water, because water is a polar substance. And importantly, polar substances like to be around other polar substances. Nonpolar substances like to be around other nonpolar substances, but the two don't like to be around each other. And that's why you exist, and any organisms exist, specifically because of this molecule. Phospholipids are examples of molecules that we describe as being amphipathic. Now, what about this path part? Pathos. What does that refer to? It refers to feeling. Same root as in sympathy or empathy. And what about amphi as a prefix? What else do you see that in? Amphibian is a good example. Because just like in symbiosis, the bi here means life, biology. Amphi means dual, D-U-A-L, or both. An amphibian is so named because it has a dual lifestyle, meaning that it spends part of its lifetime in water and part of its lifetime on land. And similarly, an amphitheater is partly outdoors and partly indoors. Amphipathic literally means having dual feelings. Now, a molecule doesn't have feelings. That's just how we talk about it. But what that means is, specifically chemically, is that an amphipathic molecule is polar at part of itself, on part of the molecule, and nonpolar on another part of the same molecule. The fatty acids of a phospholipid are carbons and hydrogens only. Therefore, the fatty acid tails are nonpolar, just like a fat is. The phosphate, though, makes the other end of the same molecule polar because of those ionized oxygens. All right, so that overall is an amphipathic molecule. Phospholipids are amphipathic. The reason why this, well, first let me describe this C. Typically, in any given textbook, an individual phospholipid will be cartoonized as a more or less spherical head with two little tails. The head is where the phosphate is, and that's always the polar part. The two tails are nonpolar, but we have different words here that correspond to polar and nonpolar. Hydrophilic, etymologically or literally, means water-loving. Phile means love. Hydrophobic literally means water-fearing. The reason these correspond to polar and nonpolar is that a hydrophilic molecule is one that likes to be around water because, just like water, it is polar. So polar and hydrophilic go hand in hand. Hydrophobic thing is nonpolar and therefore does not want to be around water because water is polar and the hydrophobic thing is not. Well, that's a single phospholipid shown in cartoon form. But you don't have a single one usually. You have millions of them. So if we go to slide 13, we can see a bunch of them. And remember, we were talking a little bit about how the first cells got started. Before there was any life, any cells to produce new cells, the first cells had to come out of something that wasn't living. Phospholipids is a big reason why this happened. And you can still do this today. A phospholipid is just a molecule. It's not alive, right? It's just a chemical. Water is not alive. It's just a chemical. If you have nothing but water and a bunch of phospholipids, and you put those phospholipids into water, they will naturally self-assemble into what we see here, which is called a phospholipid bilayer, because it's really two layers of phospholipids. Each one is called a monolayer, but the two of them together make up a bilayer. And it's not just random arrangement, it's arranged a specific way. One monolayer has the tails all arranged the same direction. The other monolayer has all the tails arranged in the same direction. But the tails in one monolayer are facing the tails of the other monolayer. And this is just showing you a little bit of it. When you have this happen in a beaker of water with phospholipids, it'll form a spherical bilayer. In other words, a spherical bag that contains water inside it and there's water outside of it. In other words, just like a cell, exactly. It's not a cell yet, but it is how cells formed originally, once these phospholipids accumulated in the water to a high enough concentration. The reason that they do this naturally is because of their amphipathic property. The heads, which are the polar parts, don't mind at all being around water, whether it's water outside the bag or water inside the bag. It's just polar things being around other polar things. All the tails are hydrophobic. They don't want to be around the water. So they get together in this way so that none of these tails is directly in contact with polar water. And that's how the first little bags started that became the original cells that are the ancestor to all of us. All right, and 14 is still another category of lipids, one that we've talked about a little bit before. You don't see its name, though, so I'll ask you to guess what this is. I did talk about it.
Testosterone?
It can be turned into testosterone.
Yeah.
Very similar to testosterone, but testosterone starts out as this. This is cholesterol, exactly. What does the word cholesterol tell you that it is chemically? Well, it is a sterol, but what does the word sterol tell you it is? An alcohol, yes. It has an OH, so it's an alcohol. By the way, coal means bile. Cholesterol is a major component of bile produced by your liver. And ster, as in stereo, means solid. Like a three-dimensional sound is solid. So it literally means bile, solid, alcohol. And cholesterol is produced by animals. Plants don't produce it. They produce something similar but different. They produce what are called phytosterols, which is a good name because phyto means plant. But back to cholesterol. For animals, cholesterol is absolutely vital. We can't live without it. And, for instance, I, as a vegan, don't take in any cholesterol because I don't eat animals. But I'm not dead. Why do I have cholesterol? Because I'm an animal.
Yeah.
The reason that animals that you eat as food have cholesterol is because they can't live without it. They produce their own cholesterol. Well, so do we. It's important for various reasons, one of which I've already mentioned. The cholesterol is the precursor to all the steroid hormones. So estrogen, progesterone, testosterone, cortisol, those all start out as cholesterol. That's important enough. But also, cholesterol is an important component of cell membranes in animals. We'll talk more about that in a different chapter. But just to give you another importance of it, cholesterol is a precursor also to vitamin D. Vitamin D is a little bit weird compared to most vitamins. We classify vitamins usually, a word that means vital, vitally needed. We can't live without them. But most vitamins are classified as vitamins because it's something that we can't live without, but we can't produce on our own. And therefore, we have to take it in as the diet. Some other organism has to make it for us, namely bacteria. But we can make our own vitamin D. Not directly, though. It's kind of an indirect process. It starts out as cholesterol. And sunlight striking the skin, the cells of the skin, converts some cholesterol into what's called cholecalciferol. You don't have to know that name. Cholecalciferol then travels to the liver, and another OH gets added to it, so it transforms it into cholecalciferol, a single alcohol, into calcidiol, a double alcohol, which then travels to the kidney and gets hydroxylated again and turns it into calcitriol, which is the active form of vitamin D. And then that travels to your small intestine and allows the cells there to absorb calcium from the diet. Without the vitamin D, you can't get the calcium in very well. All right, so anyway, that's... I'm done, right? Oh, no. This is 11:30 is when we started. Okay, well, good, because we've gotten through two major categories now, polysaccharides and lipids. 15 starts proteins, or I should say polypeptides, because I told you that's the better word. Polypeptides are also polymers, as the word polypeptides tells you. And every one of these four categories is vitally important. No organism can exist without any of them individually. But in terms of the number of important functions that they perform, polypeptides are probably most important. They do, in other words, the greatest variety of things for cells. Polypeptides or proteins do. And I've said this many times, proteins do all the important things in any given cell. You can see that by looking at this table. This isn't even an exhaustive list of functions, but this shows you that there are categories of proteins. These are all proteins, but they're categorized functionally based on how they work. And this is a pretty diverse, not only a long list, but a really diverse list of functions. Any given single protein does only one thing. So it's a member of one of these functional categories. But there's all kinds of different proteins that you make. And as we've been saying earlier today, even the types of proteins that any given organism can make depends on the instructions that it's given. It can't make any polypeptide just from scratch. It has to be explicitly told how to build the polypeptide. And that's exactly what a gene is. So the number of genes that an organism has determines the number of polypeptides out of the countless possible polypeptides that could be built that particular organism can make. And you're stuck with that list for life unless you change your genes. Okay? But any given polypeptide will have a specific function, and it won't get... There's not a polypeptide that can do all of these things, in other words. Let's just look at these types quickly. First of all, you have enzymatic proteins, or enzymes. Enzymes are catalysts. And we'll talk a lot more about catalysts later. But a catalyst is something that can drastically speed up a chemical reaction, make it happen a lot quicker. And in biological terms, what a catalyst does is make it happen quickly enough for the organism to remain alive. So they're really important. As a matter of fact, the thousands of different kinds of proteins that your body can make, a big fraction of those thousands are many, many different kinds of enzymes. By the way, do you have a feel for how many genes you have? It surprised us in the Human Genome Project, which I think was 2000. So, that's a long time for you, but it's, we thought there was going to be a hell of a lot more than there ended up being. It's roughly 20,000 for a human. But a big chunk of that 20,000 is specifically for building enzymes as opposed to other kinds of proteins. Enzymes speed up reactions, though, and we cannot function without them. Now, structural proteins are just what they say they are. They are there for the purpose of having strength, building up structure. When a weightlifter bulks up, that structure of the muscles comes from proteins being built. You're adding a lot more proteins to the body. But that's just one example. There's all kinds of structural proteins. Collagen is a big one in animals for skin and nails and so on. Storage proteins exist. It's not all that important as a category for proteins. And we talked about storage polysaccharides. There are some storage proteins as well, though. Storage of energy, that means, for the same reason as polysaccharides. Like albumin, egg white, is a source of energy for the embryo that develops in the egg. There are transport proteins, which refers to proteins that move things from one place to another in an organism. For example, hemoglobin in your body is an important transport protein. There are millions of hemoglobin molecules in each of your billions of red blood cells. So there are many, many, many quadrillions of hemoglobin molecules in you. But each one individually can hook on to four oxygen molecules and carry it around. So we pick up oxygen at the lungs, we dump it to the cells that need it, we pick up carbon dioxide with the same hemoglobin and take it back to the lungs to get rid of it. That's a transport protein, but that's just one example. There are hormones or hormonal proteins, which are signals. Talked a little bit about signals. Not all signals are proteins, but some are. In fact, most of your hormones are protein or amino acid based. The ones that are not are the lipid ones that come from cholesterol, like the steroid hormones that are not. But like insulin and most of the whole list of hormones, those are amino acid based. And amino acids are the building blocks of polypeptides. Receptor proteins. So receptors are necessary for signals. Remember, no signal does anything unless it binds to a receptor of the right type that it fits into. Well, the signal could be a protein or maybe not, but whether it is or not, the receptor is always a protein. And that makes sense, by the way, because of something important, and I've said this, but I'm going to say it again because of how important it is. No protein has... I mean, any protein has the specific function that it has, whatever it is, because of its specific shape. It's able to work the way it does because it has a specific shape or conformation. And a receptor is a very good example of that. Unless it has the right shape, it can't fit the signal into it. So it's not going to recognize any signal but the specific one it's shaped for. And then there are contractile and motor proteins. These are busy in your skeletal muscles, allowing you to move. Basically overlap, increased or decreased overlap of fibrous proteins that allow your muscles to contract, which is the only thing your muscles can do actively. They just get shorter, and therefore they can pull on things. They can't push on things. But contractile proteins. Motor proteins move things around in the cell. We'll look at those later. And then there are defensive proteins, which are important for your immunity. Your antibodies that you develop in response to a vaccine, for instance, are specifically shaped proteins that allow them to recognize specifically shaped antigens, which are foreign materials, something that's not you, but that could hurt you. And by recognizing them, which they do by binding, they put into force sets of reactions that get rid of the antigen and protect you from dying. All right, we'll continue with proteins next time. Enjoy the weekend.